1 Peter 3, 8 through 17, the eighth talk in a series on 1 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 23, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We're continuing on in 1 Peter. We're in chapter 3. At the end of chapter 3 is one of the strangest passages in the Bible. There are some strange passages in the Bible. This is one of them. It speaks of how Christ went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison who once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark. It was my intention to include that section this morning. I had done some reading and thinking about that passage in the past, and I started to work on that to kind of confirm my thinking on that passage, and the more I looked at it, the harder it got, and the less I thought I knew what it was that it was saying. So by the time I got to the end of the week, I decided I'm not going to talk about that passage today. I'm going to wait until next week and give myself one more week to think about what's going on. So, I mean, the reason I tell you this, just so that you're aware of the situation, I spent my entire week studying the passage that I am not speaking on today. I don't know if you should worry about that, but I'll invite you to consider what you're about to hear in the appropriate light. So it's not that I haven't looked at what we're talking about today, but definitely I'm hoping for some sort of burst of insight this next week on that passage coming up, because it's quite challenging. So we're in chapter 3, starting in verse 8. We're only going to go as far as verse 17, adroitly missing the passage I don't want to talk about today. Starting in verse 8, chapter 3, to sum up, let all be like-minded, mutually compassionate, loving your brother, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. For let him who means to love life and see good days refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. And let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and deference. And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. Okay, so let's start with verse 8 then. He says, to sum up, let all be like-minded, mutually compassionate, loving your brother, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. So let me just be honest about what happens to me when I read a passage like this in the Bible. Every time you come across one of those lists of virtues, and there are a number of places in the letters in particular where an author will give a list of virtues that we're supposed to embrace, and there's something about it that at first, my eyes sort of glaze over. I just don't quite take it in. It all kind of seems to add up basically to, well, you should be a good person. And that's great, and I agree, we should be good people. But there aren't really very many people in the world that advocate you should be a bad person. I mean, you don't have to be a Christian to think that it's a good idea to be a good person. So what is important to me, and what I think we want to look for when we come across a list like this, is to try to understand the rationale. What does this have to do with the faith? What does this have to do with being a Christian? Why is Peter putting it in this list? He's in this book, he's talking about our faith being tested, living out the implications of our faith. So why is a list of virtues like this, is it, in fact, and why is it something that arises out of our very faith itself? So that's what we want to try to understand here. Let me remind you how I see what Peter has set up in the beginning of the letter, the kind of the structure and foundation for what it is he's talking about in the letter. He has told us that in Christ, God has called together a people for himself. And he has given his people these great promises that should be the focus of our existence. As Peter said, set your hope completely on the grace to be revealed to you. So God in Christ has called this people together and given them this great inheritance, this great hope. Meanwhile, as God's people in the world, having to live as God's people in the world now, there are these three things that are true about our situation. We are God's people. We belong to God, and we're called to learn about him and to emulate him. We are a people together. We have been called together. We belong to each other in a certain sense. As believers, we have this bond greater than any other human relationship because it is an eternal one. And we are called to love each other as brothers and sisters. And then the third aspect is we are a people in the world. As believers, we live in a world of people whose hearts are hard against God, and we are called to live out our faith in their midst, caring for them even if they don't care for us. So this is the picture that I see that Peter has been developing. We have this great hope. Meanwhile, we are God's people in the world. And he's exploring what it means to be God's people in the world. And this, I think, gives us some perspective as we try to understand what it is that Peter's talking about here. First of all, notice that all of the virtues that he lists here are relational ones. Now, I don't want to miscommunicate here today. Relational issues between people are not the only ethical issues that a Christian faces. It is not true that only how I deal with other people is that's the only issue that I face as a believer. Sometimes we like to debate over, could I be a disciple of Christ if I were alone on a desert island? And I definitely come down on the side of, yes, you can. In fact, you must, whether there's anybody else around or not. But the fact is that an awful lot of our discipleship in Christ finds itself being worked out, tested, and matured in the context of how we interact with each other. And that's what Peter is largely concerned with in the letter. He talks about us, remember, as aliens and strangers in the world. And that sort of implies these two things, that on the one hand, we are in this together, we aliens and strangers, and on the other hand, we are aliens and strangers in the world, and we have to figure out how are we going to interact with the world around us. So it may be that in other places, the biblical authors might warn us not to love money or to stay away from immorality or things like that. But the virtues that Peter is concerned with here, they're all concerned with how we are going to relate to other people, with these two aspects. How do we relate to each other as believers, and how do we relate to the world around us? So we can see what he says here relates to both these themes, and I think we'll see that as we go through. So looking first at the list of positive virtues that he gives here, he says he's summing up. This is This is coming at the end of some instruction that he's been giving, first about how we ought to interact with each other, and then various aspects of submission, as he's been talking about Christians involved with the government, Christians involved with as slaves with masters, and a Christian wife in relation to a possibly unbelieving husband. So that issue of how do I relate to the unbelieving world has definitely been a part of it as well. So in this list of virtues, he calls us to be like-minded, mutually compassionate, loving your brother, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. And so it seems to me that the focus of these virtues starts with the focus on our relationship as believers. Certainly concepts like like-minded and loving your brother seem to focus on what we are called to together. And this goes very well with what Peter had said earlier in the letter. In obedience to the truth, in obedience to the gospel, we have purified our souls for a sincere love of the brethren. It is the truth of the gospel that calls us together. If the gospel is true, then you and I belong to each other. To accept the gospel as true means that we have to make room for each other in our lives. I am not the only follower of Christ in the world, and the fact that there are other ones has to mean something to me. And I think each of these virtues can be seen as following from that. We're called to be like-minded or harmonious. And I think if we explore that theme in the Bible, we'd find that we are called to find a unity together around our common faith. Not a unity at all costs, but a unity around the gospel itself, embracing the truth of the gospel, being like-minded and harmonious around the idea that we have embraced the central truth. We're called to be mutually compassionate. We are to care about each other's problems because we belong to each other. Loving your brothers. We are to truly accept each other as brothers and sisters in a common faith and destiny. We're called to be kind-hearted. We are to treat each other graciously, mercifully, kindly, as God has treated us. And humble in spirit, we are to recognize that we are no more important than anyone else. We are not to be constantly putting ourselves above others, but to take our appropriate place and be as concerned for them as we are for ourselves. Okay, so Peter says these things not just because it's nice to be nice, but this is actually a working out of our discipleship, of our following Christ. Learning to embrace each other as brothers in Christ is part of what we are called to learn. Ultimately, you cannot accept Christ and reject his people. Now, we're going to see some of the virtues Peter lists here are also relevant to how we relate to unbelievers, such as being kind-hearted and humble. That's going to come up as we go along. And what he says next, we're going to find, is definitely relevant to our relationship to the unbelieving world. Now we're going to expand here and focus on the relationship that we have to those who might be against us. And this is where he says, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. Now, it is unfortunate that this teaching is also relevant to our relationship as believers. Sometimes we do evil to each other, and we have to learn how to respond to it. So not returning evil for evil is certainly a general sort of principle that applies in all kinds of situations. But I think as we go along here, we're going to see that Peter has never really lost sight of in his mind this picture of believers in the world, in hostile territory. How are we going to respond to those who reject us and dismiss us? Well, one thing, we're not going to strike back. We're not going to return evil for evil or insult for insult. What's most significant to me here is the rationale that he gives. Instead of returning evil for evil, we are giving a blessing instead, for you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. So let's think about this. We are to bless those who are doing evil to us, because we have been called to inherit a blessing. Let's talk about this idea of blessing. It can sound like a very religious sort of word, but it's a fundamental concept for every single human being. We are all seeking that which is going to make our lives worthwhile. We're looking for that which is going to bring blessing and not curse. We're looking to solve the problem of our life. Every single one of us recognizes the challenges that we face, the unhappiness that there is in life, the fulfillment that always kind of seems to elude us, that even the best things in life don't seem to ultimately solve my problem as a human being. I'm looking for blessing. Everyone is looking for that thing that is going to make life good. Well, Peter started his letter by reminding us that the believer has this great inheritance, this great hope. The gospel is all about reconciliation with God so that he might rescue us and lead us into eternal life. And eternal life is not, remember, it's not just breathing forever, but it is real life. It is finally solving the problem of human existence, where sin has been dealt with and death has been dealt with and the futility that we struggle with has been dealt with. And we find existence as people under God finally as satisfying as life is meant to be. That's the great hope that we have in front of us. That's a blessing. If you could arrive at that, if you could get to this place where God is taking his people, you would find that life has become what life is meant to be. Why did Christ die on the cross? So that God might do good for us, so that he might bless us rather than curse us. If the gospel is true, then that is the story of every believer's life. God in his mercy promising to bless us rather than curse us. That's the deal. That's what it means to be a Christian, is to be one who has been promised by God that blessing ultimately will be ours. Well, if I'm truly looking to God for blessing, and I believe that he will keep his promise, then that has to affect how I see other people. God has dealt with me kindly, so how should I deal with others, even those who hate me? As Jesus said, God sends the rain on the just and the unjust alike, and I am called to be like my Father. So if I expect a blessing from God, if what I am looking for is for God to bless me, then I had better embrace the loving and merciful values that God has shown me as I'm dealing with other people. This leads Peter to quote from Psalm 34, which is this next section here, which he has already referred to earlier in the letter. He has quoted from it before, alluded to it at least. Now he has a large chunk that he quotes from the psalm. He says, "For let him who means to love life and see good days refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile, and let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." Okay. So, again, I don't know about you, but I find it very easy to respond someplace between indifferently and negatively to a passage like this. I mean, it sounds like everybody's preconceived notion of what it means to be a religious person, right? Do good and God will bless you. Do bad and God will curse you. Well, that sounds reasonable, but doesn't Peter know that I'm a sinner and that I cannot earn God's approval through my good works? Well, yeah, I think Peter has made it clear that he knows that. So, there's something else going on here. I don't think that this psalm is setting out a picture where those who are without sin find life and those who have sin find destruction. That's not the picture that's being painted. But we need to clarify that a little bit. then? What is the psalm getting at? First of all, I think we can see that implicit in the psalm is a kind of hypocrisy that it's warning against. We see a person who wants to love life and see good days. He's looking for blessing from God. He would like life to go well. He would like God to make his life long and good. And yet, the picture that's painted here is of a person who has totally rejected the values of God. At least that's the person you don't want to be in the psalm. This person refuses to treat others with the blessing that he himself is looking for from God. He will not refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. When he talks to other people, he says evil things and he lies to them. He will not seek and pursue peace, but instead, presumably, makes himself an enemy of all whom he dislikes. So I would argue that in the psalm, the picture is not just one of a sinner, who we all are, but it is a picture of an active hostility to the values of God. This is not a picture of a person who has moral struggles. This is a picture of a person who has refused to acknowledge that he needs to live in accordance with God's values. He's a hypocrite. He wants God to bless him, but he will bless no one else. Peter says that the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and this may sound terrifying. I mean, if we're saying it is only the righteous that God pays any attention to, I tend to identify more with when Paul said, there is none righteous, no, not one. I hear that and say, yeah, Paul, that's right. You know what you're talking about. But I would like to argue that oftentimes the Bible, especially the Old Testament, uses the word righteous to mean more like believing or faithful. The righteous person is not the person without sin. The righteous person is the person who is following God, the person who believes in God and trusts God and is actually looking to God for the direction of his life. I've never met a sinless person, but I have met many people whose hearts are open to God, people who trust God and who are trying to learn what it means to follow him. Well, in terms of the psalm, those are the righteous that we're talking about. This is ultimately where the title for the book that I wrote, Righteous Sinners, came from for me. I noticed in the Psalms, it was particularly in Psalm 32, that the righteous were described as those who confessed their sin to God. Now there's kind of a conundrum for you. The righteous are sinners, and yet they are described as righteous, and they are ultimately accepted by God. God forgives their sins, but the wicked are rejected. So in that psalm, the difference was between the sinners who confess that they're sinners and the sinners who don't. And the sinners who confess that they are sinners, they're the righteous. So I think that's the kind of language that the Old Testament uses quite a bit. The righteous are not those who are without sin. The righteous are those who have put their faith and trust in God. They take God seriously because they believe that he's there and they're looking to him for life. So I think that's what Peter sees in the psalm that he's quoting. He's not saying if you have any sin in your life, then God doesn't like you. But what he is suggesting is that ultimately you can't live with this hypocrisy. The psalm is painting the picture that the one who is going to find life from God is the one who is willing to take God's values seriously, to treat other people not evilly, not lying to them, not being unwilling to seek peace with them, but rather reflecting the values of God, seeking to provide the blessing for others that I am looking to God for myself. And I think that's what Peter is seeing in the psalm. So that's what we're called to, basically, not to be hypocrites, to be looking for a mercy and blessing from God that we are unwilling to provide to others. So Peter goes on in verse 13, "And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and deference. And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. Okay, so we can see here that Peter has never really wandered far from the theme that he started in chapter 2, verse 12, where he said, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Peter is concerned with how do we conduct ourselves amongst people who may have it in for us, who may be slandering the very faith that we have embraced. What are we going to do about that? He starts by making this statement, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? Well, we need to stop and think about that for a minute. It's not hard to think of who might harm you if you're zealous for what is good. I mean, Peter knows very well that much of the suffering that his readers are facing comes from people who don't like their faith as believers. And Peter himself is going to be executed not long after he writes this letter just because he preaches the gospel. I mean, if I understand when the letter was written, it's not long till his execution is coming. So I don't think that he is suggesting that the very act of doing good is going to keep people from seeking your harm. But I'm inclined to think that he has in mind more something like, who can really harm you? Who can ultimately harm you? If I am following God, then who can keep God from blessing me? And this is a very common theme in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament. This is very much in the spirit of what Jesus says. Don't fear men, because all they can do is kill you. I mean, we're supposed to stop at that and go, wait a minute. That getting killed by somebody, that's kind of what I'd like to avoid. So that doesn't sound like such a good deal. But it only makes sense, it only ultimately makes sense that he would say a thing like that if I recognize what is the source of blessing. What is it that ultimately is going to make me secure? And it is not making the rest of the people in the world happy with me so that they don't try to do anything to me. That's not the ultimate source of security. The ultimate source of security is having God on my side. You know, as Paul said, if God is for us, who can be against us? That's the idea. And I think that's what Peter is getting at here, is that ultimately they can't do anything to you if, in fact, you have put your trust in God. But that isn't to say that they can't make me suffer in this life. They can. And that's why Peter goes on to say, but even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. You may not ultimately be harmed, but you may have to suffer as a follower of Christ. But it is blessed to be in that situation. You're fortunate. You're in a good place if God is so much on your side that other people don't like you for it. Now, this is the kind of spot where I stop and say, I'm saying this like, oh boy, it's obvious, you guys. Why don't you get with the program? Suffering is good. Well, I don't like it any more than anybody else here does. Let me just be honest about that. But there's no escaping it. This is what we're called to. I mean, just look anywhere you want. You want to argue that I'm misunderstanding Peter? Just open your Bible at random, probably, and you'll find something that alludes to this kind of idea. Peter is agreeing with Jesus and the prophets and Paul and all the other biblical authors. The blessing that God has in store for his people may come at the cost of suffering in this life, but it is worth it. That's just the story that we're told. That's what we're being asked to embrace. Now, and we should embrace it because it's true. Now, let's remember here that Peter's concern is relational. We could talk about the inner attitude that we must have, and he will allude to that here. But ultimately, what he's concerned with is the way our belief and confidence in God is going to work itself out in the way we interact with each other. But in particular here, the focus is on how we are going to interact with those who would oppose us, those who would slander us, those who would seek our harm, those who are causing us suffering because they don't like the faith that we have embraced. So it really covers the gamut. I mean, we're talking about how I would respond ultimately to mistreatment from the most trivial to the most serious. Well, so how are we going to respond? What does he want? The response starts in the heart. We sanctify Christ as Lord in our hearts, he says. That is, I think what he's saying there, we are sanctifying, we are setting apart, we are declaring Christ as unique and holy, as the Christ, as the Lord. We ourselves are personally deciding that Christ is indeed the Lord of all, the bringer of life, and that we ourselves are committed to following him. So the first step is that I myself in my heart am making this commitment. Yes, Christ is Lord. Life is to be found with him. He is the one ultimately that I'm following. This is an alternative to fear, as he spells it out. We may have enemies, but we should not fear them because Christ is our Lord and protector. So ultimately, the place that he's calling to us to inside is to embrace the truth of the gospel and who Christ is, what he is doing for us, so that we might be able to set aside fear, that we might be able to recognize that God is on our side and that ultimately we don't need to fear those who we're dealing with. Having that internal foundation, then, he calls us to do two things. I'm going to reverse the order in which he talks about them here. We respond to others with love and humility so that any slanders that are made about us as Christians are diffused. And then we stand ready to explain our faith, to give an account of the hope that is in us. Sometimes that language, always being ready to make a defense, is taken to mean that we should always be ready to win any debates that we get into with non-Christians. I mean, the idea here is that I should be ready to make a defense, so I should study apologetics and be prepared if anybody, you know, pulls Darwin on this, okay, I gotta move for that one. And somebody pulls the Crusades on us, go up, I gotta move for that one, and that kind of thing. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think legitimate questions deserve legitimate answers, and I applaud our attempts to take seriously the objections that people raise against the faith and try to understand if there's any merit in those objections and why those objections have not kept us from embracing the faith and why we don't think those objections should keep them from objecting the faith, rejecting the faith. So, I didn't say that right. Somewhere in there was what I meant to say. You'll find it. So, that's all good, but I don't think that's the focus. When Peter talks about being prepared to make a defense, I don't think that's the focus of what he has in mind. If we look at the context here, what he's talking about, the emphasis is someplace else. He wants humility and love to characterize our lives, not returning evil for evil, but actually communicating to anyone that we are concerned for them, that we are on their side, so that people will ultimately be interested in what makes us that way. Their slanders against the faith ultimately will be diffused, and perhaps they will become interested in what is it that is driving you? What is this hope that fuels your life? And then be prepared to explain to them why it is you live the life that you do. You don't have to be a biblical scholar to do this. You don't have to have studied apologetics to do this, because I don't think he's saying be prepared to deal with every argument a skeptic might make, although that would be fine, but that's not his focus. His focus is basically love your neighbor, and when he asks, explain the hope that gives your life meaning. I think it's really that simple. His recommendation to us in dealing with a hostile world is not to be hostile back. And then if that gives you an opportunity to actually be heard by someone, then explain to them what it is that is giving the focus and the purpose to your life, which is the gospel itself. So it's fairly simple, I think, the picture that he has in mind there. All right, so let me say a couple of things about what we've been looking at here. First of all, I want to point out again the emphasis that Peter has in this letter on the way our discipleship is to work itself out in our relations with other people. This is Peter's main concern in the letter. I am called to be a brother to Christ's people. I am called to be a blessing to the unbelieving world. That's what I'm called to. To be a follower of Christ means to be concerned for his people the way he is concerned for his people, and to be patiently open and welcoming to the entire world the way he is as well. This is what I'm called to. And Peter's focus naturally is on how we react in terms of those relationships. Other people can present a problem. I don't know if you've noticed this, but other people can present a problem. My brothers and sisters can be a pain in the neck, and the world can ignore me or reject me or even try to hurt me. Peter is calling us to lay a very strong foundation in our own understanding and commitments. The rock-solid dependability of God is to be our foundation. He has promised to bless us, and we can depend on him. I mean, it's a simple idea, but that's the way things work. I mean, when you have confidence in someone, then you rely on them, you trust them, and when you're going with them to do something, you do it with a certain confidence because you're counting on them to have your back, to be on your side, to be able to deal with problems as they come up. If you have great confidence in someone, then you'll go into greatly difficult situations because you're confident that they can deal with it. Well, that's what ultimately being a believer is calling us to, that great confidence in God, that God is on our side, he has shown that he's on our side, and that we can count on him to ultimately redeem our lives, to make something of this mess, to pull us out of our own moral struggles and the problems that we find with other people, and to ultimately bring this to the place where we want our life to be. That's what we're counting on him for. That's the foundation. The more that foundation is laid, the more I come to personally embrace that that's true and have confidence in that, the more that can affect the way I react to the rest of you. The more we understand the confidence that we ought to have in God, he has promised to bless us, and we can depend on him. The more we understand this, the more this frees us from fear. What can man do to me? God is on my side. And with that security as a basis, then, we have the freedom to sacrificially love the world. We have the freedom to not strike back at our unbelieving neighbor who has sought to harm us, because we're going to be all right. And God has called us to love that person the way he has loved the world. So that relational aspect, as I say, it's not the only aspect to being a believer. Being a Christian is not just being nice to other people. I mean, that it's a fuller and richer thing than that, and there's more involved than that. But if the gospel is true and I have embraced it as true, then I can't ignore the fact that it has implications for how I think about my fellow believers and the world at large. Let me return to what the psalm said there for a second, just to emphasize again the problem there, that language, God's eyes are on the righteous. Theologians often talk about the tension between law and grace. If you're familiar with that concept, on the one hand, we have all this language about mercy and forgiveness and the grace of God, and yet on the other hand, we have commands and exhortations to do certain things a certain way. And in this psalm, we have this language, God's eyes are on the righteous, those who do evil, he's not listening to them. He don't have anything to do with them. That how do I fit together? Where do I find that balance place where grace and yet the demands of God meet? Well, we have to live with that tension. There are ways that you can try to eliminate the tension by eliminating one side or the other. You know, let's just talk about grace and we won't talk about the way I ought to live or anything. That's just, if I talk about that, then I'm not talking about grace. There is this place in the middle. I'm always talking about that place in the middle, but for most things in the faith, it comes to this place of balance between two inappropriate extremes. On the one hand, we need to take seriously the grace of God. It's not just so God overlooked your faults because you had a few, now go and do good things. I mean, we're talking about a serious moral corruption in each of us that we have to take seriously and recognize how much mercy God is showing us. We need to understand the grace of God so much that we could go home today and look deeply and seriously at the moral realities in our own life. Look at some of the worst things we've done. Look at the terrible things that you may go home and do today. And yet, look at them in the light of the mercy of God. This is why Christ died on the cross, because it's bad. If I were to get what I had coming to me, it would be bad. That's why the cross has come to be the symbol of Christianity in a very appropriate way, because the cross is the place where Christ brought about our reconciliation with God, and we needed reconciliation because we don't deserve his favor. But on the other hand, who is it that receives this mercy? It's God's people who receive this mercy, and God's people are those whose hearts are teachable and trusting. The lives that you and I are living together today, we are living as disciples, as students. We're followers of Christ. Our primary teacher is Christ himself. Our secondary teachers are each other. And I don't mean like me getting up here and spouting off all my wonderful wisdom. I mean me being a pain in the neck and you having to figure out whether you're going to forgive me or not. That's how I'm your teacher. We don't have a choice. If we're going to follow Christ in faith, then we have to submit to his lesson plan. This life that we're living now, the main purpose of it is so that we might have to confront reality, which we are so good at denying. I mean, that's the fundamental truth about human beings. If you don't know this about yourself, you've got to figure it out. What you want to do is deny reality. What you want to do is paint a picture that is different than the way it really is so that you don't have to make certain hard choices or confront certain things about yourself. And we're all that way. But being a follower of Christ means we have to deal with that. That's what he's called us to. That's what Peter's getting at in his letter. And one of the ways that we're going to have to deal with that then is we are called to bless those who curse us. We are called to look at the person who is against us and say, well, a lot of things. If I were to receive what I had come unto me, I would be in deep trouble too. And God in his mercy has reached out to me, who is just like that person over there. So if I'm going to be a follower of Christ, if I'm going to recognize the mercy that has been shown me, I don't really have a choice. I've got to confront the fact that I am called upon to emulate God's mercy as I'm dealing with that other person, which means I'm not going to strike back. I'm going to act in such a way that I'm trying to seek their good, which ultimately is going to mean I'm trying to act in such a way that I at least am not getting in the way of them being able to see the gospel clearly. My goal is to not get in the way of their being able to see the gospel clearly. That's the most loving thing I can do. Will we find sin in the lives of believers? You know my answer to this question. I say this every time so we don't all freak out. But absolutely. I mean, I'm not happy about that. It's just a reality. It's there. But the followers of God are not embracing that sin and justifying it. We're following God and trying to learn something different. No one has the option of saying, God, I will take your salvation, but I will not follow you. Okay, then one last thing I wanted to talk about here. Some of what Peter's saying here I think is pretty relevant to our situation in the world today. When you hear that language about the things in which they slander you, I don't know, maybe it's always been this way in the history of the world, but we certainly, in our culture, we as modern-day Christians in America are getting a reputation. There is kind of a story that's going on around about what we're like. We are haters. I mean, just if you ever, you have to be careful about this because this could really get weird. But I like to wander around YouTube and look for, like, you know, old videos of artists that I like, you know, playing songs and stuff like that. And you find some pretty interesting stuff on there. You also, if you let your eyes wander down into the comments on YouTube, it is filled with garbage. I mean, it's just incredible what you find there. But if you ever, you can be going along and find some, you know, anything. It could be some old rock and roll song or something like that. And if somebody happens to make some little reference to anything that has anything to do with God, all of a sudden there will be all these voices coming up and talking about those blankety-blank Christians and how they hate everybody and how, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. We're getting that reputation. We're haters. We are fanatics. There's no difference between you and the Islamic terrorist who goes and blows up a bus of school children. It's all just religious fanaticism. It's all the same sort of thing. And lots of other stuff. I mean, I think we're being slandered in the court of public opinion out there right now. Now, unfortunately, some of it is true. Some of the things that we are being accused with, you can find people doing the very things that we're being accused of in the name of Christ. And so, I mean, can't say it doesn't happen because it does happen. But we are, in fact, being slandered. The faith is not what it is being portrayed to be. And we are not what we are being portrayed to be, I would say. So what would Peter say to us to do? What should we do? Well, I'm not saying that this is the complete answer. I'm not saying that Peter would not advocate anything else, but he is advocating something here that we need to take real seriously, I think. The best thing that we can do is to not let the slander be true in our own lives. We're being slandered as haters, but we are called upon not to return evil for evil, but to bless instead. We are called upon to submit with deference and respect. We're called upon to love our enemy. That's what Peter's saying we should do in response to that slander. We should love our neighbor. We should be humble. We should seek their welfare. Ultimately, I mean, is that going to make a difference? Who knows? Probably the odds aren't even good that it's going to make a difference. But at least it provides the opportunity. If your neighbor is willing to be fair, he will have to admit that you at least are an exception to all of those haters out there. Somehow you're this anomaly. I know that Christians are terrible people, and you're a Christian, but you seem to be okay. So you're a hypocrite. Who knows? But I mean, is that, am I saying that is going to happen? Absolutely not. Who knows? It may or may not. But that's what Peter's calling us to. And then we have a chance to talk about the hope that drives our life. It is the best thing that we can do is to be a loving follower of the God who is merciful to evil and terrible people, and let people see that in our lives and perhaps then be willing to talk to us about what it is that makes that characteristic of our life. That's what I understand Peter to be calling us to. And that's very important. Now, am I saying that you shouldn't write letters to the editor or whatever? No, I mean, go for it. That's fine. I don't care. But I think in the end, ultimately, we have sometimes gotten the idea that somehow political activity or big social movements or something like that, where we fight against the wrong message, that somehow should be the focus of our actions. We may be called to do that kind of fight at times. I'm not against it. But we are fundamentally, each one of us, whether we ever write a letter to the editor or anything like it, we are called upon to be humble, loving people that give people a chance to see what it is that the gospel actually looks like in someone's life. And that's what Peter's calling us to, I think. Okay, so I'm open for any questions you might have. I just have to be honest with you guys. I was at a wedding late last night. I'm really tired. It's amazing to me that I managed to get through that. I'm dizzy. I'm about to fall over. I can hardly keep my eyes open. So this is the part where I need to understand your questions and comments and interact with them. I had this part written down so I could look at it. So just forgive me if this doesn't make any sense, and ask again next week and maybe I'll be awake. So, Jonathan, go ahead.
Hey, Rob. I suppose I'm just wondering what implications what you're saying about 1 Peter has for this one particular thing, which is the following. Namely, when people are like, hey, they hear I'm a Christian or something like that, and they're like, well, Christians are, you know, awful. And there's a part of me that chooses or has chosen at times as a strategy to be like, oh, yeah, I don't like them either.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm not like that. I'm some exception.
Right.
And what I'm hearing you say in 1 Peter is there is... it's not just like my relationship to the world, but my relationship to other Christians is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And that I'm supposed to be bearing with them in some way that is somehow... a different strategy that I've taken, I don't know if I'm answering my own question and talking out loud. I apologize, but
that's great. And today is a good day. Today is a good day to answer your own question, too.
Another strategy I've taken is, that's the sort of God I have, is I get to call those people my brother and sister. It's even the ones, God is a God of a faithless people, and I'm yoked up with a faithless people, and I myself am faithless at times. And if you don't like that sort of thing, then you certainly won't like being a Christian. So rather than trying to distance myself from all these people that I may not see eye to eye with in any way, shape, or form, but there's also this reforming part of the church. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could, like, yeah. There's this tension there. On the one hand, I want some distance, but on the other hand, there seems to be this call to actually be yoked up with these people in a way that's bearing with them, and that love for them is kind of a rhetoric to the world, you know, or it speaks to the world and trying to persuade them.
So. Right. Yeah, I would find myself someplace in the middle of that, I think. The way I would tend to answer that in talking to people is that the Bible itself, especially the New Testament, but really the whole Bible, one of the fundamental warnings that it makes is the warning against the seductive attractiveness of religion as a means to self-righteousness and condescension and superiority to others and that kind of thing. And so I think what I would acknowledge is Christianity is just, as a belief system, is just the same as any other religious belief system in that it can provide cover for that kind of behavior and attitude. And acknowledge that I think there is some of that in the world, but at the same time, I would say with you, I mean, we need to distinguish between those who are using Christianity as a means to promote their own self-righteousness versus those who are just struggling along to try to understand what it means to take God seriously in a world that doesn't take God seriously and who make a lot of mistakes and who sort things out. And so I think that making that distinction is important. I think I would challenge someone, if they really want to get in my face about it, is that you can't really... You're not really in a position to judge unless you are willing to make that distinction and try to see how that distinction is operative in the world. So, and I don't want to be self-righteous or see myself as superior to anyone else. I understand the faith to be about God being merciful to me, and I need mercy. So that's what I want it to be about. And then just ultimately have to leave it to the person to decide whether they're willing to cut you some slack and acknowledge that that's possible. But both things that you're talking about seem important to me. It's finding that place to make room for both of them.
Hi, Ron. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me, and I've been struggling with this whole idea about sin for a long time, and, you know, how is it that, and, you know, I really appreciate your having written the book, Righteous Sinners. I need to go back through it again with everything that I've been learning here at Reformation Fellowship. This whole idea of sinfulness, and I was just writing these notes as we were going along. It seems like sinfulness would not be evil if we were always able to think in terms of eternity, because especially as I've experienced it, you know, when I first came to the gospel per se, it was that I wanted to receive Jesus so that I wouldn't go to hell, and that harkened all the way back to when I was a little tiny kid and I heard about death for the very first time, and you know, and I said, well, Mom, what's going to happen to me when I die? And she said, well, you're going to go to heaven. Well, then the whole idea about the conditions involved, you know, got clued into me, you know, in my late teens and early 20s. And so then it's like, well, most of what we deal with in our everyday lives has it's a very momentary experience. The mind does not grasp that there is this ongoingness about what each and every event that happens in our life is about. And so then, you know, I'm just grasping to try to describe this here, what eternity is not just then what happens after death. Eternity is going on here and now. So then that makes real the whole idea of you know, God being God. for most of non-believing world, and I was a part of it for a long time, and I came to understand these things better, and I like to think I'm more of a believer than not right now. It depends on who you, the sinfulness idea depends on what you think of who you are as a person. I'm just babbling along, but
no, I think I see what you're saying.
You know, if you're just here to just do what there is to be done, which was kind of the way that I was raised, then how is any of this ever going to make sense? Well, it's not going to until you have an experience in your life where you realize maybe this matters. You know, maybe stuff that I'm doing and thinking matters, and I don't know. It seems like it's relative that way.
Right. Well, if I understand what you're saying, I'm very much with you there. I mean, that what you're saying, you know, eternity starts now. I'm sure I've said this many times before, but there was this phrase that I'm sure you've heard before that I learned fairly quickly when I became a Christian and was warned against this. They talk about the person who is so heavenly minded that he's no earthly good. You know, if you've heard that phrase, or you don't want to be a pie in the sky Christian, you know, pie in the sky by and by when you die, but you want to focus on right now. But as I understand the picture in the Bible, the kinds of analogies that are used are like a woman in labor. Okay? A woman in labor, in one sense, is very focused on what's happening right now, but in another sense, the whole point of it's aimed at a result that the birth will come about. Or the imagery of Israel in the wilderness. They're in the wilderness being led by God, but they're going to the promised land. So, yes, I'm in the wilderness. I'm journeying along, and I have to find water, and I have to set up my little tent and do all that stuff. But the very act of being in the wilderness is filled with this significance because I'm pointed in a direction and I'm going someplace. And that's why Peter says at the beginning of the letter, fix your hope completely on the grace to be revealed to you. Not think about nothing but heaven and refuse to talk to anybody else or just sit in your room and think about heaven. But he's saying, think about where you're headed as the thing that gives meaning to all of the stuff that you're doing now. The choices that you're making now, either that's true, that you have that hope in front of you, or it isn't. And if it is true, then it makes all the difference as to how I think about what I'm doing. And that's what I hear in what you're saying.
Okay. Preach it, brother.
Okay.
Well, Ron, as you've been teaching these last couple of weeks, and I'm kind of taking that big gestalt picture of things of the multiple manifestations of love and dealing with grace and righteousness, remembering the old black and white film San Francisco, which stars Clark Gable, Jeanette MacDonald, and Spencer Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't do it, I have a quick written synopsis of the scene I want to discuss. Clark and Spencer portray lifetime friends. Clark becomes a hustler, a materialist, hedonist, and Spencer becomes a Catholic priest. And they like to go out boxing. And Spencer, the priest, invariably wins each match, but they both have a good time and somehow maintain this relationship. It's quite wonderful. When Spencer lovingly confronts Clark over how he's treating Jeanette very poorly, Clark punches Spencer in the face. Spencer calmly repeats what he said. Clark punches again. Spencer repeats again. Clark punches him a third time, and by now Spencer's nose is really bloody, and Clark just panics and runs away. And noting, Spencer could have decked Clark with a single punch, but he didn't. So I could wax eloquent about all these things, so I'll just give this as a reference of a film. So if you're looking for a good film, this is one to see.
I approve of film references here, so...
two questions. It seemed like in 8, you were talking about... You seem to be saying that the that he's referring to be harmonious with regard to the truth amongst believers. That those terms in 8 are kind of referring to how they should be amongst believers. So, okay. So that's kind of, I just wanted some clarification on that. It seemed like when it gets down into 13 and on, that it's more, I don't know, focusing on their interactions with non-believers. Mm-hmm. That's just what I heard. Clarify that, if that's what you were saying or not. And then the other thing, it seems like I'm in 15, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account. It seems like, I've interacted with a lot of Christians who are very results-oriented and take that passage and, you know, this is about me changing somebody else. Does the first clause there, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, it seems like it, always being ready to make a defense is a continuation of that same thought, and it seems like it's more about it's more about us being ready, it's more about where we're at. If we really do care about this stuff, you know, if this is, something that is important to us, then the idea of being ready, it's like, do I care about this? If I don't really care about it, I'm not going to think about it very much. I'm not, someone asks me, I'm going to be like, oh, I'm not, you know. Someone comes at me and says, you know, those Christians are all bad. And they're like, oh, yeah, right, yeah. They're bad, you know, because I'm not really caring about it. I'm not really thinking about it. It seems like it's more about what's going on in our hearts as opposed to, there is an element of caring about the result that could happen.
Right.
And conducting myself in a way that could possibly.
But it's not a technique. I mean, this is not being advocated as, watch, you'll get good results with this, because you may not. I mean, we just know that sometimes, you know, sort of paradoxically, treating someone well can get them angrier, you know, and you can't do anything about that. So, yeah, so it's not a technique, and you're right. There is a part of the motivation which is being concerned about the other person, as I would see it, as what he's telling us here, is that I am concerned. You know, there's a not striking back that could be motivated out of, I'm so superior to you that I wouldn't deign to strike back. You're not even worth hitting back. I'm so much better than you. It's not the act of not hitting back motivated by something like that we're talking about. It is out of this picture of the love of God, the mercy of God toward myself, and and open, keeping open that possibility that someone might be able to see that. That's what I'm understanding. So, but it's having that attitude fundamentally that's important. And the results, yeah, it's hard to say what they'll be. I mean, Peter was executed. Ultimately, I mean, maybe he stopped using the technique or something, but I doubt it, actually. So, and then your first question, yeah. See, there are, you can see in his letter parts that are clearly focused on believers, our interaction with fellow believers. Put right up then next to places that are definitely focused on our interaction with hostile unbelievers. In this section, that first language, when you talk about like brotherly love and that kind of stuff, like-minded, as if I'm understanding what that word means at that spot, that does seem to kind of imply the sort of thing that would largely apply to how I would be interacting with those that I see. I mean, who are my brothers, who we are seeking unity together, and that kind of thing. And how I deal with those who are evil towards me and who slander, and I'm trying to undo the slander by undercutting it and that kind of thing. That does seem to fit in with his language about how you conduct yourself among the Gentiles and their slanders and all of that kind of stuff. So you can see it kind of sorting itself out along those lines, but that's why I was trying to say as I went along, it's not that you can't, I mean, the principle of not returning evil for evil also applies to me as I'm dealing with other believers, and being humble and kind-hearted applies to me when I'm dealing with anybody. I mean, a lot of it could be applied to in just about pretty any relationship, but I do see Peter in his mind, he sees these certain problems, and some of the language kind of sorts itself out towards this and some towards that. I don't know if I was very clear about that, but that's why it wasn't clear, because maybe I wasn't clear.
So it's not, it seems like a logical, it could be like 13 and down, is a clear transition. Do you see a clear transition, or do you see it kind of gray, they can each apply to both, or this is mine automatic switch?
Well, you could see the transition happening right in the middle of verse 8. I mean, you got the five positives, which are the way we interact with fellow believers, and then the don't return evil for evil, which has turned its attention to, I don't know if it's that neat, though. I'm not entirely certain. It's hard to say ultimately. Oh, we can say, though, if you look at the concepts that he's using there, those same concepts in other parts of the letter are clearly applied to the situation of dealing with fellow believers, or likewise clearly applied to the situation of dealing with hostile unbelievers. So in a way, it is kind of neat just to say, well, dividing line right there. So, but I'm not sure. Okay, well, let's stop with that then. Thank you.